Welcome to Letters on Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich. The ancient story of Gilgamesh is the oldest long-form story that we have, dating back to potentially as early as 2500 BC. That's arguable, and we'll talk about those dates. It's from the eldest civilization that we know of, right there with Egypt, and that's Sumer, right between the Tigris and Euphrates River, which today is modern Iraq. Gilgamesh is a story about tyranny, sex, friendship, immortality, death, environmental destruction, and wisdom. It is an epic, nothing short than about a story of the journey of life itself. There are stories and symbols throughout the epic of Gilgamesh that could be found in the Old Testament, including the flood and also the serpent. And though debated, it's believed by most historians that the story of Gilgamesh is much older than the stories that we find in the Bible. So today we're going to be in conversation about this story, the story itself, and also its history. My guest is Kent H. Dixon. He is a translator of a new graphic novel that takes the words of Gilgamesh and puts them into pictures, pictures that were drawn by his son, Kevin H. Dixon. It's called The Epic of Gilgamesh. Kent H. Dixon, it's my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio station. Thank you for being here.
Tremendous pleasure.
I'm excited to have this conversation. I've always wanted to have this conversation. Let's put the timing of this story of Gilgamesh, and it's not, we don't know exactly when it came out. There are wide estimates, and we could talk about that. But I think it's safe to say this, that the New Testament, the stories of Jesus, are probably closer to us in time right now than the stories of Jesus were to Gilgamesh.
By a factor of two,
yeah,
three, and even four.
Yeah.
Old Testament earliest is maybe 600, a little bit after Homer, 600 BC, Genesis and things like that. And where they get most of the Gilgamesh, the so-called standard version, is around 1200 BC, but there are pieces that they use to plug in and fill the missing pieces in the puzzle that go back to 2500, as you say. And if you push it, you can go into the beginning of Sumerian literature as early as 3500, 3800, when writing begins, actually.
So there are many, we have many historic examples of this story.
Yeah, all over.
And the one that we know of, the one where we get, and we don't have the entire story, actually, but where we get the most story comes from these tablets, not from 2500 BC, but more like around somewhere between 1000 and 1300 BC.
Exactly.
What is that?
We were talking earlier, Ashurbanipal goes nuts and collects everything he can.
And Ashurbanipal is the king of Assyria, ancient Assyria.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Around, I think, 600.
Yeah, 600-700 BC, yeah. In that area.
And that's, they excavate that palace in that kingdom, 1872 is when they start finding it, and there's tremendous amount of stuff there. In fact, there are more tablets in fragments and complete untranslated today than all of classical literature translated, Greek and Roman.
Interesting. So these tablets, they were found in what we call Ashurbanipal's library.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I remember I went to the British Museum a couple of years ago, and I found collections of Ashurbanipal's library. And I never take photos of myself. It was the only time I've asked somebody to take my photo with me in it, with the library behind me. That's how excited I was to find it.
Yeah, I'm always running around with the huge statues that are 30 feet tall and having my wife, you know, shoot me there. You're a third as tall.
And so what Ashurbanipal did is, again, he was known for his library. And he must have collected these. So he had old books then, because again, these tablets that were found there were predated Ashurbanipal.
Yeah.
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 It would almost
right.
be like for him, if we had our library today, we had original texts of Shakespeare, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And then of course copies of, and then they find pieces everywhere, and then they find pieces where the language is actually quite different from the standard version that they use. So they have to work that out. And for a long, long time, those were, you know, they're in Iraq, they're in Iran, they're in Paris, they're in Philadelphia, you know, they're in Chicago, at the Oriental Museum. So a scholar would have to go all over the world to look at these originals and make the drawings of the cuneiform. And that slowed everybody down tremendously. Imagine that. So we mentioned him earlier. Andrew George comes along. He manages to go everywhere and touch base with every single place where these things are. So he pulled together the most thorough transliterated thing, translation.
So the story of Gilgamesh that we have, again, it comes from these 12 tablets written somewhere between 1300 BC and 1000 BC. It's in cuneiform, the Akkadian language. But as you said, you go further back into the time of Sumer, as far back as 2500, maybe even further. We have what, then little examples that are actually in the original Sumerian language?
Don't think of cuneiform as a language.
It's a writing.
It's an alphabet.
Right. So it's a writing of Akkadian.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, it's Akkadian, it's Babylonian, it's Assyrian, it's the Hittite use it, the Edomite. Everybody used it, and it goes on for a long time. It goes actually on into about 70 or 100 AD. People are still using it.
These are distant relatives of Arabic.
Yeah. Well, no, not the cuneiform, but the
Assyrian
is. Yeah. They're all Semitic languages, except Sumerian. They don't know what that is, and that's very hard to translate.
So when you put this story together, the Epic of Gilgamesh, does one just use the 12 tablets, or are there other pieces of it that we have found that add to the story, or does it just confirm to this story?
There are other Gilgamesh stories out there. There's one where, Ababu or somebody like that is laying siege on his city, and all he does is stand up and loom over the rampart walls, and it scares the enemy away. Or the very nice one that Tablet 12 is stolen from, he's moseying along, and Ishtar wants this certain tree because she wants to make a throne out of it, but there's a demon in it. Gilgamesh chases the demon out. She rewards him with his stick and his puck, his meku and his puku, and then cut right there. That's the beginning of Tablet 12. Oh, that he hadn't gone to the carpenter's wife that day. Oh, that he lost his puku and his meku. That's this old Sumerian story of Gilgamesh cut in half because they wanted the underground journey much later on. It's probably added 1,000 years after the standard version that we're looking at.
So why is it that we're missing portions of the story still?
Well, the tablets get broken, lost, never quite sure what the final version is. What we've got now really fits plot-wise. Everything sort of, you know, articulates off of each other and works. There's a good flow. And, but, you know, 2014, they come out with a virtual tablet, 30, 35, 40 lines of Humbaba and his kingdom, where Enkidu and Gilgamesh go to kill the monster Humbaba. And he's like a Persian king or something like that, with all these servants and an orchestra and so forth. So it didn't really fit our
translation.
That's
very interesting, because that's very different than the standard story that we told about this.
So how do you bring that into what you've got? It really conflicts, except for when you first go into the forest and all the animals are chirping and the monkeys are screaming. It's really beautiful, and Andrew George has a nice translation of that. But then it goes on making Humbaba a kind of satrap, you know, and we didn't like that, so we stayed with our old one.
You stayed with the old one, yeah. Because Humbaba is sort of this mystical
monster
creature. That's the defender of the forest.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's his forest, yeah. And he's put in charge of it by the gods. I mean, when Gilgamesh and Enkidu kill him, they're making a big mistake. But he's horrible. His face is swirling intestines. His one glance is death. He breathes fire. He's immense. Not a good guy to fight with, and they nearly get wiped out.
Yeah.
He's swinging them around, and he's banging their heads together, and he's digging ruts in the ground, trenches with with their bodies, and somehow they bring him down.
Cuneiform, the word actually means wedge, and it's because you actually create a wedge into a clay tablet to write the language.
Imagine a flat piece of damp clay, and then you have a stylus, almost like a straw, a reed that's been sharpened down to a point. You press that point into the clay, and that makes the head of the wedge, the kind of nail-looking head, and then you drag it a certain length, and that gives you that little arrow pointing to the right.
And that's what they are, is a series of arrows when you're looking at.
Yeah, they look,
that's what it looks like.
We were at the beach yesterday, and the sandpipers are going along, and I looked down at those little footprints in the sand. I drew a big box around it and put a couple of cuneiform characters and in it. Said, hey, Ken Henry, my grandson, come here, look.
It's not an alphabet.
No, it's they're syllables.
They're syllables.
Yeah, and sometimes a syllable can be a word. Cat, that works. So you use cat in catastrophe, in catalog, in anything where cat is going to go. You can use that little symbol for cat.
I mean, it's not hieroglyphics. It's not an alphabet.
It's better than hieroglyphic.
But is there any other kind of writing that you could think of that you can compare to cuneiform? Or is this
writing comes along out of the same design, the same method. You start with pictures. You draw a goat, and then you stylize that goat, and then after a while, three strokes represent that goat, and then you start using the word goat anywhere that G-O-A-T or G-O-T or G-E-T can fit. You have lots of options, and it slips all over because they don't care about those vowels. I and E and A are all interchangeable a lot of the time. Well, there's where misinterpretation goes and downright mistakes. You can find mistakes in every translation just by looking at the other translations and saying, uh-oh, this guy, why did he go that way? Then you can look up the actual word if you want and, hold that guy to the, put his feet to the fire.
And then, we would get an alphabet from the Phoenicians, which is the same area. I mean, sort of geographic area.
But it develops the same way. That R-A, think of a capital A. Is originally an ox upside down. Just draw the V and draw a line with it, and its two little horns are sticking up.
That's right.
It falls over on its side for a while, and then it winds up upside down, which is our right side up. It was called Aleph. We get the word alpha. And then the Greeks looked at the Phoenicians and used some of those symbols for vowel sounds, which the Phoenicians didn't. So it didn't really work as a great alphabet. The Greeks are the genius. They put the vowels in. Yeah. Anybody can read it.
So R-A is a bull.
Yeah.
Upside down.
Yeah. Yeah, That's wonderful.
Again, we are in conversation with Kent H. Dixon. He is a translator of a new graphic novel, along with his son, who is the illustrator, Kevin H. Dixon. And it is The Epic of Gilgamesh. And that is what we are in conversation about. Okay, let's get to the story of Gilgamesh. It's a great big story. And it even has, tell me about the beginning of this story. It has this sort of pronouncement, and it's longer than I'm going to quote here, but maybe this says enough right here. Of him who endured everything, him who they call Gilgamesh. Tell me about that beginning.
Well, the beginning, the actual opening line is Shan Nagma Imuru Lesuedi Maati, so forth, and it translates he who saw everything. And it wasn't called the Epic of Gilgamesh. All these ancient myths and so forth were called by their first name. So it was known as he who saw everything, or he who knew everything, or finally he who did everything. I think I plowed all of those meanings into my first page as much as I could. But what's interesting, it starts out with, like you're suggesting, with a narrator outside. And at a certain point, Gilgamesh seems to come in and take over the narrator. And you think of the Odyssey, you think of Odysseus. He's going here and there. He's stuck with Circe. And then he gets to Alcinous's island, and they finally say, who the hell are you? And somebody's trying to tell the story of Odysseus and the Battle of Troy, and he takes over, and he tells his own story. And, how did Homer come about doing that?
Yeah, you're right. There's some who say Homer.
There it is, yeah.
Was influenced by Gilgamesh.
There's a lot in Homer that
what else?
Well, the Patroclus-Achilles relationship, Enkidu and Gilgamesh. Well, there's so many literary forms. In Tablet 12, I just took a course in the New Testament, and we wound up with Revelations. And I was reading up on apocalyptic literature. Tablet 12 actually follows the formal designs of apocalypticisms. So if you look in the book of Daniel, or you look at John's Revelation, or you look a couple of other places, there's an apocalypse of Peter. And you fudge it a little bit because they're going to God in their ultimate meaning, and the Gilgamesh isn't exactly. You've got the same shape. And I've been talking to my New Testament teacher, and you know, we're starting to look at this, see if we can pull out something about it. There's you know, an apocalypse in 12 when he goes through, how does the man who had one son fare in the underworld? How does the man who had three sons? How does the man, you know, and Enkidu tells him about who everybody who's in the underworld and how he's doing, which isn't great. You know, you're eating dust and brick and clay, and it's a bad place.
Let's talk about who Gilgamesh is. He's a king of Ur, ancient city of Sumer, with the great walls. And at the beginning, he's a serious tyrant.
Oh, he's terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's young, and he's randy. He's oversexed.
He's what they call first rights.
Right.
He as king, would sleep with all the brides before the husband would.
Yeah, and then think about that. Enkidu gets really mad at that when he hears about it,
yeah,
and starts the fight, doesn't let him go into the temple to meet a first night bride, stops him. What priest is sticking his neck out against the overlords and the, you know, and the kings to find that a problem? You know, you start to see into the culture with moves like that in this.
And that's how we get to Enkidu. So you have this tyrant, Gilgamesh, who's really terrorizing his people of Ur.
Yeah, not only is he a first night rights, but he uses the young men. He keeps them from their fathers and working in the fields and stuff for his sport. So he wants to play all these field games, and he rides around on their shoulders or on their backs, hitting a ball and everything like that, so they can't go work in the fields. So he's just a mess. He's a bad king.
Yeah.
And his people complain to the gods.
To the gods.
And then the gods say, okay, we'll make him a companion. We'll take away some of his energy and focus him. And they put Enkidu together out of clay. And Enkidu comes along, and then, you know.
But he comes along in the forest or
yeah, it's a Garden of Eden. He's a complete wild man.
And he is a wild man. He is
absolutely
running with the animals,
right,
as an animal.
At the head of the herd.
And so he's not a part of Ur yet. He hasn't met Gilgamesh yet.
Doesn't speak. He doesn't eat bread. He doesn't know beer.
Yeah.
He's never had sex.
And that's about to change.
Yeah, right. They get a temple prostitute, which is a good thing, to go out there and seduce him. And they have sex for a week. And
for
that begins
days
to civilize him. He learns language out of that. On the way to Uruk, they feed him some bread with some shepherds. He nearly chokes to death. He doesn't like it, but they force him to do it. And then he gets drunk on beer. And if you do the sex and the bread and the beer, and language, you've got civilized man.
Yeah. A scene that sticks with me with in Gilgamesh is then after the lovemaking that Shamat has with Enkidu, Enkidu goes to return to his wild life, to return to the animals,
yeah,
and all the animals run from him,
yeah,
now.
Yeah.
Lost that.
Enkidu is really, he's secretly the hero of the Gilgamesh. He's the human being. He starts in Nirvana. He's in Eden running with a gazelle. He then discovers a great human act of propagation and food and dance. They have fun together. And then he goes into society and he suffers everything. You know, he warns Gilgamesh about the monster. He knows about the monster. Gilgamesh completely chickens out in midstream when they're on their way to kill him. And then Enkidu reassures him. So he kind of reverses himself. So he's really smart. And then alas, alack, he's the one that has to die. And he goes through all of that. He's got the epic journey.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes, he does. So he gets back to Ur. He comes with Shamat and they get back to Ur. And as you say, As Gilgamesh is going to sleep with to be bride, he stops Gilgamesh, and there's this huge fight between them.
Yes,
in which Gilgamesh actually wins after a long struggle.
Right.
But after this, and I've heard some people say Gilgamesh is, and I think it's accurate to say it's about many things. It's truly an epic, but it's about friendship and the importance of friendship. And after this major fight between Enkidu and Gilgamesh, they become like brothers.
They do become brothers. Gilgamesh's mother adopts him and actually gives him a belly button because he doesn't have one, because he was made out of clay. You know, he's not of woman born. And she goes, bing, this belly button appears in the comic book. I mean, Kevin does it really funny.
And so they are brothers.
Yeah, they are brothers. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, they're kind of one. They almost slip personalities around sometimes. Enkidu becomes more of a hero. Enkidu really kills the bull of heaven more than Gilgamesh does. Gilgamesh seems to be able to take down the monster more than Enkidu does. You know, it's six of one.
And Enkidu softens Gilgamesh.
He what?
Softens.
Yep. Yeah. Well, let's see.
They go out and fight. I mean, and they conquer a lot of different places and monsters and animals. But I mean, my sense was he becomes less of the tyrant.
Yeah, but he's still kind of an old teenager. When they get back from killing Humbaba and they're washing off the gore, Ishtar, the goddess of love, spies Gilgamesh in his nakedness and propositions him. And Gilgamesh sits back and says, wait a minute, you don't have a very good record with the men in your life. And he does this long list of all the men she screwed over one way or another.
She's the god of love, but also the god of violence, too, isn't she?
She's god of war,
Yeah, god of war. So.
And he, she's deeply insulted and calls down the bull of heaven. And they fight with the bull of heaven, and that's terrible. This bull is immense, and it digs a pit and 100 men fall in and he destroys half the city and so forth. They manage to take him down. Then as they're celebrating that, Enkidu tears off the thigh of the bull and heaves it into Ishtar's face. You know, so he's sort of competing with Gilgamesh at that point out of Gilgamesh's arrogance and over-energy. So there he is kind of slipping into that channel of humanity. And that's probably what, you know, gets him voted down by the gods. For one thing, Gilgamesh is two-thirds divine, one-third human. It's a little bit harder to make him sick and die.
Right.
So they go after Enkidu, and there he goes. Well, it takes an entire tablet
After
to die.
They kill the bull, they anger the gods.
Yeah.
And then they kill Enkidu through illness.
Yeah.
And this is a major...
12 days he... thrives in sweating and you know, coma and in and out and having dreams, and Gilgamesh is going nuts at bedside. And then he dies, and then another tablet 7. Tablet 8 is Gilgamesh mourning him and having statues built and making all of nature mourn him and so forth. So not until 9 does Gilgamesh hit the road.
All of tablet 8 is
mourning. All of 8 is just mourning, and all of 7 is dying.
Wow.
Yeah. So,
and Enkidu's death really is an existential crisis for Gilgamesh.
Yeah.
Because now he's facing death himself. He's not about to die at that moment, but now he knows he's going to die.
He has that great moment. I don't know when it comes for people, but, you know, there is a line you cross, maybe in your teens, maybe in your 20s, maybe not till you're 35, where it becomes more real than it ever was. And you think, oh, gee, this has to end. You know, okay, you can go and be tremendously religious and have that faith. You can work like mad to leave great works behind. You can have lots and lots of children and grandchildren. Who knows? But you make your effort, and then you're gone. Utnapishtim has a wonderful line. He just brings up a dragonfly, and he says, it's a dragonfly there, and it's gone into the sun. That's life, you know.
And I want to get into Utnapishtim in just a moment here.
Mm-hmm.
But I just want to really, because he's going to find Utnapishtim, who's this man who has
also on the way. It suddenly occurs to me.
But he's a wanderer. He becomes a wanderer.
He has this iron cold thought: I too may die, and that's kind of a turning point in the epic. So he's no longer quite mourning Enkidu. He's slipped that into his own mourning, his own life, his own the mortality.
It almost reminds me of the story of the Buddha when Siddhartha escapes from his palace where he was going to be king and becomes an ascetic and becomes a wanderer himself. I mean, that's what I was thinking when I was reading that in Gilgamesh. Reminded me of that story.
Yeah.
And so he goes on a quest to find the only immortal man that is on earth, And that's Utnapishtim. Who's Utnapishtim?
He was a king of and a priest and a scribe. And let's see. Actually, in the beginning, the gods make humans to, what do? They take a young god, kill him, and out of his body make about 7 human beings. These propagate very fast, and it gets to be immense, and they get very loud. And the head of the gods, Enlil, it disturbs his sleep, and he decides to get rid of them. And he tries everything. He tries drought. He tries disease. And finally, he comes up with this flood idea.
That's funny. I mean, again, there become too many people. They're too loud. They're disturbing the gods.
Yeah.
Well, so they bring in a flood to wipe out the people.
Enki, this one god who's very human-friendly, whispers to a reed hut, what's going to happen. This reed hut happens to belong to Utnapishtim, and he overhears it. And he says, reed hut, build you an ark, get the hell out of here, it's going to rain forever, you know, and so forth. And Utnapishtim gets everybody to, says, I am bad for you. The gods don't like me anymore. Build me an ark so I can get out of here. So he lies, fools everybody. They build this great ark, and then the rains come and everybody drowns, and this is a horrible storm.
But there are people that say this is where we get the story in the Bible of the flood.
Oh, for sure.
No doubt.
No doubt. I mean, letting go the dove that comes back, and then the raven finally that finds dry land somewhere. And so for some of the language is the same in Genesis and the story of Noah. Utnapishtim gets called the Babylonian Noah, you know, by everybody, by the scholars. Yeah, it's the flood. And when it was first published in 1872, that was the tablet that Smith published. And it caused riots. People
yeah.
threw bricks through the windows of the newspaper that published it because it implied that the Bible is plagiarizing. You know,
right. That was a big
deal.
They
didn't like that, you know. But, you know, because this is the Word of God. And wait a minute, the Word of God is 1,500 years earlier, and you don't have anything about a Yahweh in this, you know, pantheon of gods. Whoops.
I also read that you can find from Ecclesiastics in the Bible just passages that almost look as though they are directly lifted from Gilgamesh.
It's not almost. It's exact.
Is it?
Yeah. 2 or 3 lines are exact of what you can, as close as you can get to the Siduri's advice to Gilgamesh. You know, this is the real secret of life. It's my favorite passage. I love it.
So who is she and what does she say?
Siduri is the alewife out on the edge of civilization, and he comes clomping along a real mess, wearing just lion skins and everything. She lets him in, and finally he tells her his story, and she begins to believe he's who he says he is. So at one point, she gives him advice. Gilgamesh, trust me, you won't find what you seek. There's no point to your wandering. It cannot quench this thirst for life everlasting. The glorious gods. They created mankind, but with life they also gave death, gave it away, keeping eternal life safe in their unearthly clutches. Now there's an answer to this. It's your stomach, your liver, your heart, and your skin. Here, drink, eat, fill up thy stomach. Tonight, take pleasure. Tomorrow, take pleasure. Look about. All these happy, inconsiderate things, peel back their secret. Today's a holiday. It's all a holiday when you live. Invite people to your party. Dance with them. Laugh. Dance in your heart. Put on some clothes, fresh linen. Imagine caressing the skin. And as for that, and clean hair, take thee the wee child by the hand. Can you see it? It's yours. It's you. It's eternal, not this. In God's name, let me give you a bath. A wife would delight in your embrace, take joy in your lap. This, Gilgamesh, is how man and also woman live life.
This part of Gilgamesh
is... But that eat, drink, and be merry is right there in Ecclesiastes.
Eat, drink, and be merry.
Yeah, yeah.
This part of Gilgamesh and his searching for, because he has to go over... it's not easy to find Utnapishtim. But this whole part about him trying to find Utnapishtim and then finding him and talking to Utnapishtim is my favorite part of this story, because this is where, to me, the real wisdom comes in on issues of life and death.
Yeah, well, hers. I mean, she's got the philosophy.
And also, he finds her first.
Mm-hmm. But Napishtim has plenty of wisdom. He's nastier about it. You know, I mean, he's got it, and Gilgamesh isn't going to get it. And it's a little tedious for him. And he kind of slams him around. He gives him a test that he knows he'll fail, and he does fail. He gives him the gift of eternal youth. You can have youth as long as you live. You can have a young body, you know, be a 20-year-old man, woman. And it's a plant. Gilgamesh gets it. And then on the way home, he puts it down to take a bath. And a snake comes along and steals it. And as the snake slithers off, it sheds its skin. In other words, it's staying young, right? It's a sort of etiological myth there. And at that point, Gilgamesh gives up. He says, I'm not going back. And he goes back to Uruk, taking the boatman with him. And then pauses at the hills and starts bragging about the walls that he built. And he's reaching for that as his immortality, you know, the great works. I think that's ironic. I don't think that's the answer. I think you sadden for Gilgamesh there. And I love it that Tablet 12 comes along, bang.
Let's get into that in a moment.
We'll
get into 12 in a second. Yeah.
Go back to Ecclesiastes. I wouldn't say that it's all about eat, drink, and be merry. What happens with Ecclesiastes, the preacher, is he looks at life and he looks how hemmed in it is by things more powerful than you, about death, by this and that and the other thing. And he says, really, the only answer is to make the most of what you've got with your sensual body and so forth. So he's not a hedonist at all. He's saying this is the fallback position, which I never knew. I thought it was ironic. And the preacher Ecclesiastes was holding it up as what people believe, but this isn't true. You need to love God, da, da, da. It's not. He's saying this is the fallback position.
Enjoy your life.
Yeah.
Enjoy what you have.
Yeah. As cynical as he is.
Nobody lives forever.
Right? You know, Ecclesiastes, vanity, vanity, all is vanity.
Is there a transformation of Gilgamesh through this?
He does realize he's not going to win. That's me rattling. I don't know how you read it. I tried to leave it ambiguous enough at the ending so readers could go both ways, because translators go both ways. These walls are the great thing. And if you think about it, walls are the great thing. When you wall a city, you protect it from outside. It gets big enough that you have to have language to organize it. You've got all this food and people and goods and so forth. You can't keep track when you have 100,000 people living inside of, you know, a huge fortress. So there comes writing. Well, okay, that's the great. There's fire. there's. I mean, writing is huge in the development. So maybe there's an argument for that. These walls are important.
Right.
On the other hand, you're still going to die. The walls are a little bit left today, and there's the story of Gilgamesh. That's plenty for me. I wouldn't mind being, you know, ensconced in that 2,000 years from now.
Is he still the tyrant he was?
Yeah, I don't know.
You don't know?
Well, I think he's going to be better. I mean, but there aren't any passages that show. Outside of Gilgamesh, later on, he becomes a king of the underworld. And that's one reason to tack on Tablet 12, is to show what he's going to be doing, you know, down there. That's the argument for Tablet 12 being stuck on. He's big. I don't know if he changes. I don't know if he learns as much as Enkidu does.
Huh.
I don't know. That's the first time I ever said that. I got to think about it.
Let's talk about Tablet 12. And what I appreciate about your book of Gilgamesh is that you include Tablet 12. Other translations I have read of it do not include Tablet 12. And I think it's because suddenly Enkidu is back alive, as though we never left in the first place, and no explanation for it.
Well, he's a little different. He's very deferential, and he seems more like a servant than the bosom buddy. And he's kind of an idiot. He comes along and says, I'll go down there and get your sports equipment for you. And Gilgamesh gives him a long list. Okay, if you go down there, don't do this, 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 and this. He goes down there and he does all of those. the underworld just clamps him down and he's stuck. Gilgamesh goes to two or three or four gods trying to get him out, arguing for him, and nobody will even listen to him, turns their back. And then he gets to Enki, that god that warned Utnapishtim about the flood. And Enki talks to Shamash, the sun god, and says, couldn't you knock a rent in your tunnel? See, the sun goes over the earth, and then it travels back in a tunnel through, yeah, through the night, and that's how it circulates. And Shamash does, and Enkidu pops up. And then you get that long passage of, well, what's the underworld like? Here's the people that had one son, two sons, seven sons. There's a wonderful, after they do the sons, Gilgamesh asks about, well, what about the man who fell on the off the mast and was impaled by the bollards? Now, that's not a typical death. So it seems to me that's the writer, Sinleki Unini, throwing in his own personal experience. My God, I mean, you're up really close to this writer, you know, at something like that. I think you get closest to Homer in those Homeric similes that are these just beautiful pieces of poetry. And you know that's got to be an individual artist, you know, that's plugging those things in here and there. Maybe they got collected, but I see a family resemblance in them. Odysseus is being washed off the rocks and drags his hands over it like an octopus whose arms are being dragged off a rock by a tide and by a wave. And geez, I mean, was Homer blind? How do you know about that?
Sinleki Unimi. This is the author of the tablets.
His name is on the bottom of the standard version in a couple of places. Thus ends He Who Saw Everything by, in effect, Sinleki Unini. He was a priest. Sin means the moon. He's a priest for the moon. And I forget what Leki Unini means. One who worships. So he's a priest, he's a scribe, and he gets credit for pulling it together, just as Homer gets credit for taking, you know, or the Homeric tradition of pulling in all these stories and making them coherent.
There's always a debate about Homer, whether if it's one person who came up with the Iliad and the, yeah, Odyssey, or if it's many people and just oral tradition.
They're all going to many people. I like one.
You like one?
Well, I do. And I'm writing a movie about that. Uh-huh. Homer, it's like Shakespeare in Love. It's how Homer, as a young boy, gets to be Homer the Great. And I'm 40 pages in.
What do you think about Gilgamesh? One author or many?
The stories are out there. There are four or five non-epic stories of Gilgamesh. One guy, I think his name is Gardner, has a 500-page novel where he puts all the stories together. And in fact, to give him credit, he comes into Tablet 12 as a dream. But I went and looked at the publication of that, and I looked at my filing with the Library of Congress, and I got it first. So I didn't get it from him. But anyway, good work, because it's a great way to hop over to 12 and justify it.
And the part of the problem with Tablet 12 and understanding how do we get to having Enkidu around again is that there are parts of it missing. The beginning of it actually is missing.
Well, it's not missing. It's there. The writer cut in as close as he could to get to that business about what goes on in the underworld. Well, to do that, you've got to get Enkidu down there, and you've got to get him trapped. Okay, why does Enkidu go down? Oh, Gilgamesh lost his sports equipment, and he can't reach it. That's where it starts. Before that is that long story about how he got the sports equipment and Ishtar and the demon in the tree and things like that. That's just lopped off.
It's just lopped off, yeah, on the,
yeah,
tablet.
Yeah, but you can find it. I mean, those are Sumerian tablets. In fact, I looked at one of those tablets in Philadelphia.
Kent Dixon, what does this story, the Epic of Gilgamesh, mean for you? Why have you spent so much time having to learn at least partially the cuneiform to be able to do this?
And I remember in college when I first read it, and Gilgamesh sets out, and it occurs to him that he's going to die. And I was probably 22 or something like that. And I thought, this is really stupid and primitive, this epic. I don't want to read it. You know, it's like I don't like Beowulf that much, you know, and I was reading that back then too. And I was also taking a lot of classics courses and reading Homer and think, this is gorgeous. This is amazing. And I didn't think much of it. Then I started using it in classes because I taught the Iliad and the Odyssey, and I wanted an early epic, and it's fun sometimes for students to write a paper and say, hey, this is going on in Homer. Could it possibly have started here? And, you know, those make for good short undergraduate papers. And then I didn't like any of the translations, so I finally started one of my own. That grew. Took me, I don't know how long, a couple of years probably, to pull it together from all those other translations. And then, you know, you do something like that enough, you get to know it. And like I'm learning about it now through my son. He's got jokes in here that are slightly interpretive that I am just discovering.
Yeah.
He slipped them in. So the thing is still growing for me, and I follow the lore. What's the latest with it? What's going on? Translations.
As I told you, this is the third time I've read in my life Gilgamesh, and this actually doing this and getting ready for this was the most meaning I've gotten out of it so far.
Mm.
It's worth going back to it.
It really is, because Kevin gives you a whole nother layer. I mean, you don't get a lot of the jokes. You don't get the irony. When she asks for the bull of heaven from her father, Anu, and he says, well, if I give you the bull of heaven, it's going to cause a famine. Have you laid up grain for the people? And she says, of course, I've laid up corn for 7 years and so forth. Well, when you read that in a translation, you can read right through it. You don't see that she's lying. So Kevin just has her with her fingers crossed behind her back and a kind of smart-ass face saying, lying to her father. Well, he's got things like that all the way through. So, you know, a younger reader, a college student in a hurry, is rushing through the prose, sees that picture, suddenly the human dimension, you know, just extends.
Yeah. And how about for you as translating it? Did you find more meaning as you worked on this?
Well, that, you know, I started with, that's a really stupid question. I'm going to die too. And it makes him cold in his heart. Because I thought I knew that at 22. Well, you know, at 32, 42, 52, it changes. At 72, it's really changed. And, you know, why not? That's the question to start with. What are you going to do with your life if it's going to stop and that's it? And, you know, the three deaths, you know, with the three deaths, right? You drop dead, then that's one. Number two, they have a service for you and say nice things and bury you. That's your second death. The third death is when everyone and everything on earth has forgotten you and you're oblivion. That's the third death. And, you know, who knows anything about Sinleki Unini or... Yeah, but we do know that he knew somebody that fell from a mast and was impaled on the bollards, and he gives him a fairly decent condition in the underworld. That's kind of nice.
And that's the story of Gilgamesh. The story of Gilgamesh is, you're going to die. You better live. Seems simple, but this is the earliest story of that
and it's really implied that he can get back now and be a good king, having gone through all this. What's the point otherwise? It's not like he's as stupid as he ever was or as arrogant. There isn't a line that helps you jump to that. I think you have to know it. There's theories that they, certainly somebody is reading this because nobody could read it except the scribes and a few kings. But a reader... Like, I've got a whole idea about Homer, that as Homer would chant this stuff, he would take characters, and there's some scenes in Homer where if you move around a little bit, you can have characters overhearing what other characters are saying, just how you move on the stage. I just think he might have been doing that. But they even go beyond that and said this might have been performed. So somebody is reading it, and there's actors doing certain things. Maybe in that, you know, maybe in the visual comic version, you can get to that answer, that he's a reformed king, that he's learned, and that just being the master of these great walls and the great works isn't the whole answer.
Because that's how these stories were told in the ancient world. They were spoken. They were performed.
Maybe. I mean, they don't know. Nobody's said it. But that's a good bet. And they certainly were spoken.
Yeah.
You know, no, nobody could read it. Homer, they don't have any alphabet for Homer, right? It's not written down. So it's all memorized. Probably, a chapter at a time. Maybe would memorize, he'd shoot out maybe about four in a day, then you'd spend overnight, then they'd pay him again, they'd do the next four the next day. 24 of them, that's a good job.
Yeah. Kent H. Dixon has been our guest. Again, Kent H. Dixon is a translator of a new graphic novel, The Epic of Gilgamesh, and the illustrations are done by his son, Kevin H. Dixon. Kent Dixon, I thank you for doing this, and I thank you for being here and having this conversation on this wonderful story.
On and on. I could do it. I'll come back tomorrow. We'll do the next four chapters.
I have to return to Homer.
I loved it, Mitch. It's great.